Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger here with Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening. On Frank Lloyd Wright's 150th birthday, we'll bring you a big announcement about the future of the David Wright House. And we'll hear from the new chief of police in Mesa. That's all to come.
But first, the housing crisis hit the entire nation very hard. But the effect on Phoenix was one of the deepest and darkest, and the number of foreclosures grew at an incredible rate. For some, that offered unprecedented opportunity for investment and profit. And one of those people is a close friend and advisor of President Trump. Thomas Barrack built an unprecedented real estate business by purchasing homes and increasing rents. And Barrack is the subject of a new report by Aaron Glantz, a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron, thanks for joining us for a few minutes.
It's good to be with you.
So what did you learn about the condition of at least some of the homes that Barrack's Colony Starwood Homes Company bought? It sounds as though, based on your writing, that things from the outside look pretty good, but from the inside, not so much.
Yeah, these are nice houses in the suburbs with lawns. I visited many of them in two of his biggest markets, which are Los Angeles and Atlanta. Outside, they look pretty nice. But when you went inside, you saw a tremendous amount of maintenance that was simply not being done. Roofs leaked, heat didn't work, a ceiling fan fell on a young mother while she was in bed with her baby. Luckily, she was okay. And when people would try to get assistance with these problems, they'd call an 800 number for this company, which goes by the trade name Waypoint Homes, although the corporation name is Colony Starwood Homes. They call Waypoint's 800 number and be sent. It's basically like calling the cable company into a a never-ending option of menus until the problem got worse and worse. And I haven't been to any of the 2,000 homes that this company owns in the Phoenix area. I'd be interested to know if we see some of the same conditions there.
Aaron, how much profit are we talking about? It sure seems as though this was a very good industry for Mr. Barrack and others.
Well, what they did was they bought low. When people in Phoenix and across the Southwest were getting hammered with foreclosures, they swooped in and bought up as many of these properties as they possibly could. And Barrack's company now owns over 30,000 single-family homes across the country. And what they've been doing with these homes is bundling them into a brand new kind of mortgage-backed security. So basically what they do is they take all these little homes that they buy, scattered all around Phoenix and other cities around the Southwest, and they take a huge lien against them, just like you might take out a home equity loan to repair your kitchen. But they take out home equity loans of amounts like $500 million. And so, if you look at one home in Phoenix, you'll find that there's a lien against it of $500,000, $500 million, $600 million. And all of that is going into the pocket of Barrack and his other investors.
So, Aaron, this sounds like such a complicated web, I guess. How did you begin to unravel this?
Well, I started to ask a very simple question, which was, if the economy has been in recovery now for a number of years, why is the homeownership rate still so low? Why last year did it hit the lowest rate in 50 years if the economy is supposedly getting better? Who are the winners here? We all know who the losers are. The losers are people who would like to be able to buy a house and can't. And so that led me to these big private equity firms like Blackstone, like Colony. There's another one called American Homes for Rent that have been buying up tens of thousands of homes, each of these companies. And I decided to focus on Colony for two reasons. The first is that the founder of the company, Tom Barrack, is the best friend of the president. So that seemed interesting. And another reason is because in Atlanta, the Federal Reserve found that this particular company had filed eviction notices against one-third of its tenants, which is double the rate of mom-and-pop landlords in that community. And so it raised the question, is there something about this particular company run by a close associate of Donald Trump where we need to be providing some additional scrutiny as the media?
And Aaron, briefly wrap this up for us. Looking ahead, because of the relationship that Barrick and the president have, could there be some reforms that really help him even further?
What we already saw on Donald Trump's very first day in office, he was actually still on the Mall in Washington. He had just taken the oath, and his administration reversed an order by President Obama that would have made it easier for people to get a home loan through an FHA mortgage. He basically made it more expensive and pushed home ownership out of reach of probably a million people. And as we go forward, we're looking at a variety of similar situations where the administration is going to have to make a choice. Is it going to make it easier for people to buy homes, or is it going to make it easier for big private equity firms and publicly traded companies like Tom Barrack's to buy up all the homes, keep them for themselves, and jack up the rents?
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Republicans have to work quickly if they hope to pass their replacement for the Affordable Care Act by the end of summer. The U.S. House passed its version, the American Health Care Act, last month, and now the Senate is expected to push its own version. A concern for many in the health care debate is Medicaid, which would be scaled back significantly under the House plan. And a new report shows that could particularly hurt rural Arizona. KJZZ's Will Stone covers health care, and he joins me to explain. So, Will, Medicaid covers nearly 2 million people in Arizona. What do we know about how the program affects small towns and rural areas here?
That's right, Lauren. It has a huge impact on populations here in Arizona. We know Medicaid, what we call access here in Arizona, has a disproportionate impact on rural areas. The report from Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families found that nationally about 45% of children enrolled in Medicaid were in small towns. And in Arizona, that number's even higher. It's 54%. And that's about 18% higher than the metro areas of the state. For adults, the number is not as high, but it's still the highest. Arizona has the highest percentage of folks who are covered by Medicaid in rural areas as well. So many of those are covered by the program. They're low income, women, children, people with disabilities. But in Arizona, where we expanded the program under the Affordable Care Act, low income folks, what are referred to as childless adults, are also covered by the program.
Okay. And how would the House replacement plan, the AHCA, impact those people?
The legislation cuts the program dramatically. It's by more than $800 billion over the next decade. It would be converted from an open-ended entitlement program where the federal government kicks in money as more people join to one that's capped. So basically giving states a limited amount of money and allowing them to figure out how to make that work. The law also phases out the Medicaid expansion, which this report found has already brought down the uninsured rate in rural America. So it's likely many people could lose their coverage here or at least see it altered. And capping the program would especially hurt Arizona, some experts say, because, you know, our program is already low cost and efficient, and we have a growing high need population. I spoke with Joan Alker, who's one of the study's authors, and she says slashing the program could have a profound impact, not just on individuals' health care, but the well-being of the communities. I spoke with her via Skype.
With the level of cuts that Congress is contemplating in the repeal of the ACA, Arizona is very much at risk. And there's no way that the state could make up the difference there. They would have to move to cut provider rates or limit enrollment, depending on what tools, you know, the federal government gives them to make these cuts.
And politically, we know that rural America and Arizona went for President Trump in the election. So the question is, will the president be okay with the economic repercussions of this bill on his base?
Right. So what's next in this debate, Will? Do we have a sense of what Congress will do now?
It's been reported by NPR and others that the Senate has been secretly crafting its own health care repeal bill that it hopes to get passed before the summer recess. It's expected that they may try to make that more palatable to moderates, like like Senator Jeff Flake, who, like our Governor Doug Ducey, may have concerns about how cutting Medicaid will play out in Arizona. There's also the Children's Health Insurance Program, what we call Kids Care here, and that covers children from families who don't quite qualify for Medicaid but are still up to 200% of the federal poverty line. So right now the federal government is paying all of our costs for that program. But if that level of funding goes down, our program is automatically frozen. And you'd see 20,000 children have joined it since we reauthorized it. So it could impact that as well.
All right. That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
Thank you.
Today marks 150 years since legendary architect Frank Lloyd Wright was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin. It's also a key date in moving closer to ending a nasty neighborhood dust-up in Phoenix's Arcadia area. The David Wright House, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright for his son and daughter-in-law, had been a relatively quiet locale for most of its existence. That changed when the house was purchased by attorney Zach Rowling, who intended to turn it into a place people could visit and learn more about Wright and his legacy. But would it become a commercial space in the quiet neighborhood and bring concerts and public events? That's what some of the nearby residents worried about, and it led to flyers and signs popping up that read, "Right House, Wrong Place." That conflict dragged on for a few years, until now. Rowling is gifting the David Wright House to the School of Architecture at Taliesin, which used to be known as the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture. It's the largest gift the school or the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation has ever received. Earlier, I met with Rowling and Aaron Betsky of the school at the Wright House to find out about the gift and its impact on architecture and Wright's legacy. I started by asking Rowling why, after years of conflict, the arrangement with the school made sense now.
Well, my mom and I started the project because she wanted this to be a community space and to give people across the valley the opportunity to have the beautiful experience of seeing a Frank Lloyd Wright building, and also to be inspired, to bring creativity in their own lives. And the Taliesin Fellowship is the very natural institution to realize those goals in the very highest sense. My mom studied architecture and was an elementary school teacher years before that, and had always admired the Taliesin Fellowship and that creative community that the Wrights created and really reinvigorated his work late in life. And the 50s were a period of major experimentation for him, and certainly the David Wright House is part of that era of immense creativity for a man, in his 80s designing a family home for his son and daughter-in-law.
Aaron, how important is this partnership going to be to the future of Taliesin West, the architecture school?
It's transformative. It really gives the school the chance to build on the legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright and on the incredible experience we have at Taliesin, Taliesin West, of living architecture. That's our motto, live architecture. And bring it now into the middle of the valley. Through Zach and his family's generosity, we get to be part of the center of the valley, and we get to use Frank Lloyd Wright's legacy that spirals out of the existing landscape into a better future that we as students and faculty want to design for the Valley and for the world beyond. It's an incredible opportunity for us.
How many students could be here at one time? What are the possible things they can do here?
The site is absolutely remarkable, and it's going to be even more remarkable when we get done restoring it and redesigning it. We're a very small school, probably the smallest architecture school in the world. There's right now about a dozen students in our graduate program. We'll double that this fall. But we will have several faculty members and students living here, no more than four. That's kind of the maximum right now. The students will be working here. Starting this fall, they're going to be working on redesigning the site to bring back the original orange grove. The house was designed to rise up out of that orange grove. And the students will be working here. There'll be a design studio here where not all of the students, but maybe a dozen of them, will be working away. And obviously, we'll also invite the community to be part of that process.
How vitally important is it to be almost enmeshed in what he actually created?
On a very immediate level, just because it's a daily inspiration, and I can point to things, I can have a student look up at the ceiling where we're sitting now and say, see, that's how you can do a ceiling. But what's very important is that we're not interested in imitating Frank Lloyd Wright. I always tell the students, don't ask what Frank Lloyd Wright did. Ask what he would do. So what we want to do is extend His notion of building with the land, not on it. His notion of breaking the box. His notion of building for an American democracy. You know, I like to say to the students, if you want to learn how to design pretty boxes, there's plenty of schools where you can learn that.
So as we know, there had been some conflict leading to this eventually. So for people who had been concerned about noise, parking, et cetera, how does this agreement affect that?
Well, I think that the concern had always been that a house museum could struggle and deteriorate into a commercial event space. And our aspirations had always been that this would be an educational and cultural and community space. And now that it will be controlled by and operated by an 85-year-old school of architecture founded by the most influential architect in American history, all of the programming will be consistent with that graduate school's curriculum, and the cultural and community programming will be derivative of the traditions of 85 years of, at Taliesin West and Taliesin. So it takes it out of the commercial realm into a very high educational realm, which I think diminishes virtually all of the concerns.
When did you first discover Frank Lloyd Wright? When did he pique some interest for you?
I grew up a mile and a half down the canal, and my mom took me here on bicycle in second grade. So this was the building that introduced me to Frank Lloyd Wright and to architecture, and this was the start of a lifelong love that my mom and I continue to share.
Why did it affect you in such a way other than being a child? Is there something about Frank Lloyd Wright that, obviously we'll ask the architecture expert as well, but what makes him linger? What makes him so easy to connect with for so many people?
There is the beauty of the buildings, but I think more importantly, there is a sense of place and a spirit of the age. And this building and this place, I think, captures the essence of what people love about Phoenix. It's the mountain views. It's the water that feeds the orange groves. It's the big sky, and it's this spiral house rising to the heavens, but made with very simple materials. And it's the idea that thoughtful design and creativity can transform how we live and how we experience nature around us.
For me, it was a slightly different experience. You know, I'm an American, but I grew up in the Netherlands, and I grew up in a sort of standard suburban home, went off to college in America, came back and went, darn, I never realized that the house in which I grew up and every other house in the Netherlands ultimately would not have looked that way if it hadn't been for Frank Lloyd Wright, because he had such a strong influence on Dutch architecture, beginning of the 20th century. And everywhere I've lived, you see that kind of influence in a completely different way. But I tell you, one thing that's remarkable, and it's true, and Zach talks about it with great passion as well, about this house, but it's true, every place he designed, you get there, and your first reaction is, it looks so absolutely right, exactly where it is.
Aaron Betsky of the School of Architecture at Taliesin and Zach Rawling, owner of the David Wright House in Arcadia. Today marks Frank Lloyd Wright's 150th birthday and the official announcement of Rawling gifting the house to the School of Architecture. And you're listening to the show. A number of states have moved to tighten up their laws on voter identification and what voters need to have when they go to the polls. And last month, the Trump administration announced the creation of the Commission on Election Integrity to investigate allegations of voter fraud. But critics have said that commission could be used as a method of suppressing voting rights. One of the most vocal is former Missouri Secretary of State Jason Kander, the president of Let America Vote. Kander will be in the Valley on Saturday to be the special guest speaker at the Arizona Democratic Party's Heritage Dinner, and he's with us. Jason, what are your biggest concerns about the president's commission?
Well, the president's task force is a total sham. I mean, when Donald Trump made up the lie that millions of illegal votes were cast in the 2016 election, which is how he justified losing the popular vote, Mike Pence and other Republican politicians saw an opening to nationalize their efforts to complicate voting and to suppress voters. And so, you know, it all started as a way to soothe President Trump's ego, but the truth is that this has been part of the Republican political strategy for quite a while, which is to make voting harder for folks who are a lot less likely to vote Republican. And now what they're doing is they're trying to legitimize that strategy by putting it under the office of the president.
What does Let America Vote? What does the Democratic Party do to counter that?
Let America Vote, we founded it because we saw what was going on in terms of the president trying to make people believe that, you know, there needs to be more laws to make it hard to vote. And we realized that it was time for there to be a political strategy against that. And what I mean by that is that for there to be political consequences for politicians who try and make it harder to vote. So that's what we're doing with Let America Vote. We are making sure that constituents know when their politicians are trying to make it harder to vote, particularly when they're trying to make it harder to vote solely so they can make it easier for themselves to get reelected. And I think that's a really important cause, and we've had a lot of support for it. We've been going a little over 3 months. 55,000 folks nationwide have signed up to volunteer, and we're excited about it.
What should the requirements be for someone who is an American citizen and can vote? Should there be some sort of ID required at the polls? Should there be anything like that?
Well, yes, and there are in every state in the country, really. I mean, and that's really what they've done to try and confuse this whole thing, is they just say that it's voter ID, right? Like, that's what they'll call it. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of voter suppression, but if you're talking about voter ID, they just call it voter ID. We were going to refer really accurately to these laws that that the Republicans want to push. You would call it a requirement of one very specific, very narrow form of photo identification, right? So, like, in a lot of states where they want to have, quote-unquote, photo ID, they don't allow for a student ID. They don't allow for an expired driver's license, as if just because you quit driving, you cease to be that person in that photo on a license that was issued to you by your state. A lot of states have requirements where you can show the little card that comes in the mail to your house from the local election authority. You know, you get from your county recorder a little card that says, here's where you vote. It's got your name on it, your address. And they only send that to your house. Makes sense that if you want to show that, you can vote. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to identify yourself. But the truth is that a lot of these laws that they're trying to pass make it so that eligible voters who are registered legal voters who have been voting for a really long time, well, these are people who, by the way, often show up at the polls and they've been voting there so long that the election officials know them by their first name when they walk in the door. And, you know, these laws would keep people like that from voting.
Jason, whether it's individual state laws or alleged Russian interference in the elections, would the nation be better off if it could be done well to have a federal election system as opposed to state by state?
You could argue that federal or state by state, whatever it is, gets you to the point where you have more convenience met at the polls. I think that elections should be, in terms of administering them, should be about three things. The first is making sure that only eligible voters vote. That is largely being accomplished in this country. You are statistically more likely to be struck by lightning as an American than you are to commit voter impersonation fraud. But then second is to make sure that every eligible voter has the opportunity to vote. And then I think third is to make sure that eligible voters meet more convenience at the polls. And what I mean by that is that, you know, Americans have a certain understandable level of customer service expectation, right? I'm speaking to you right now on my phone, which is also a device that I could use to tell my TV to, record the Royals game. I'm a Kansas City Royals fan, record the Royals game tonight if I wanted it to. And yet, we have an election system that says that I may have to stand in line for 2 hours to vote. I'm not complaining. I'm saying Americans in this day and age have a very reasonable expectation that that could be done better. And frankly, it can be done better. And there are states that are doing it with a great deal more convenience. But there are a whole lot of people in power who want to stay in power. And they're Republicans. I mean, I'm just trying to be real. Like, I'm not trying to be partisan. They just happen to be Republicans who are doing this, who feel that because people who are unlikely to vote Republican happen to also be pretty easy to target with these kind of laws, well, they're not all that interested in making it easier to vote.
Jason Kander is president of Let America Vote, and he'll be the special guest speaker for the Arizona Democratic Party's Heritage Dinner that's coming up on Saturday. Jason, thanks very much for the time.
You bet.
Earlier this week, President Trump announced a plan to privatize the nation's air traffic control system, separating it from the Federal Aviation Administration. It's an idea that's been floated on both sides of the aisle since the 1990s, but it's never come to fruition. The president said recently that the system now is ancient, broken, antiquated, and horrible, and it badly needs modernization. Commercial airlines have long supported privatization, and the Air Traffic Controllers Union is generally supportive of the proposal as well. But the effort comes as the airline industry is safer than ever. There hasn't been a fatal crash of a domestic airliner in the U.S. in 8 years, according to the Washington Post. And getting a privatization plan approved by Congress could prove to be a challenge. Democrats in Washington have expressed opposition to the plan, and so have business aircraft operators, private pilots, and some flyers' rights groups. For more on this, I spoke with Paul Lewis, Vice President of Policy and Finance with the Eno Center for Transportation, a nonprofit think tank.
The first proposals to spin off air traffic control from the Federal Aviation Administration was actually under the Clinton administration in the 1990s. And that didn't happen in large part from opposition from the workforce and the labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was proposed again under the Bush administration, and recently again proposed and supported by the Trump administration. This time around, we have support from labor unions, but the problem today is that in an era of hyperpartisan politics, anything that the president supports, whether that's this president or even in the last administration, becomes a poison pill
right.
for the other party. And in order to make this happen, it will likely have to be a bipartisan support, because there are some conservatives that are against the proposal as well.
Right. And so before we sort of get into the debate over it and the politics here, talk a little bit about why the FAA was created to begin with. What is it supposed to do, and why is it now a government agency?
Pretty much every country in the world really had a need and for some kind of air traffic control system, and most of them put it into their federal government. Most other developed countries, in fact, all other developed countries, have removed the operational side of air traffic control from their government and moved it into either some kind of government corporation or nonprofit entity, and left the function of the federal government, the federal agency, to manage the safety of air traffic control and oversee the safety of air traffic control and of the system at large.
And so your organization, you're a nonpartisan think tank on these issues, but you've issued a report in favor of privatization here. So tell me, why do you think that would be a good thing in this situation?
A few years ago, we wanted to look at how we could modernize the air traffic control system through a system called next-gen air traffic control. Next-gen air traffic control is using GPS instead of radar-based navigation to help increase the efficiencies and increase the safety of how we fly around. We thought that it was an internal problem within FAA as to why they weren't able to roll this out, but what we found was that other countries that have split off their air traffic control system from the government have been able to implement these technologies much more rapidly and much more effectively. And so it's not an issue of the quality of folks at FAA and their work ethic or the management structure, but it's rather a problem of the agency's governance as a whole to modernizing the system.
Hmm. And so there's a lot of red tape they have to go through anytime they want to do any big change like that.
Yeah, and it's not just red tape, but it's the fact that they're trying to implement a multi-billion dollar upgrade in a system that needs annual appropriations from Congress every year.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, they're not always sure what they're going to get, particularly when there's budget cuts or sequestration or government shutdowns. That dramatically affects how an operating agency is able to roll out new technologies and innovations. A agency that is somewhat removed from government, that's self-funded through its own user fees, has the ability to bond against those, make strategic investments, and focus on the operations and efficient implementation of new technologies to better the airspace for everybody.
But many will argue, though, that fees levied by a private corporation could drive up the cost of flying. What's your response to that?
So we're not talking about a private for-profit organization. We're talking about a nonprofit whose governing board would be made up of folks that would want to see fees go as low as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the experience in other countries, there's no incentive for them to increase fees. And in fact, If you look at Canada, which has a nonprofit model, they've been able to slightly reduce fees over time, and if you actually adjust for inflation, they've gone down quite a bit, while also increasing the amount of planes in the sky.
So overall, do you think privatization will ultimately benefit the American people who are flying in the skies, or do you think it could help airlines more?
I think it's both. When we went and looked at this from a truly nonpartisan, independent perspective, the bottom line is that it's good public policy. It's something that has benefits for everybody and has demonstrated success abroad in countries that are very diverse politically and, frankly, has done a good job of increasing efficiencies, increasing innovation, and maintaining very high levels of safety.
All right. Paul Lewis is the Vice President of Policy and Finance at the Eno Center for Transportation. Paul, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely.
And you are listening to the show.
The Mesa Police Department has a new chief of police. Ramon Batista, who has been the assistant chief of police in Tucson since 2014, was just introduced as the new head of the department, and he'll be in charge of its 1,200 employees. KJZZ's East Valley correspondent Jimmy Jenkins is at the Mesa Police Department now, where Batista and other community leaders have just spoken, and he joins us live. Morning, Jimmy.
Greetings from sunny Mesa, Lauren.
Hi. So start by just giving us some of the highlights of what Batista said this morning. What are his priorities looking like as he becomes chief here?
Okay. Well, he was just seemed, you know, very flattered, very grateful to the community. And we heard a lot from council members and other people that spoke about how this was a very community-oriented selection process. So he made a point to thank all the members of the community. There were actually two different advisory councils that kind of helped narrow the field down to the candidates that were eventually in the top three. And so he just kind of reiterated his thanks for the community buy-in. He introduced his family. He said, you know, he's excited to become a part of the Mesa family, moving up from Tucson. And, you know, it was just a general welcoming sort of speech.
Jimmy, we did want to get some general priorities, but one thing that you've reported extensively on is Mesa's vote to privatize its jails. How would that affect the chief? Did anyone ask him about that?
I asked him about that after the speech. He said he would be a very active member in the inspections that will take place. So under the contract, Mesa has the ability to, you know, I think, pretty much check out all aspects of the process, the ride-alongs, the facilities. So he said he's going to be a very active member of that. I was going to reserve any further statements and judgment on it. This whole process was, of course, set up by Interim Chief Dvorak, who was one of the candidates for the job. So he was pretty much the point man for this whole operation. New Chief Batista said he's going to kind of, you know, check it out, wait and see.
Right, Jimmy. And with the sort of new immigration priorities of the federal government right now and how that can affect local police departments working with federal immigration agents, is that something that Batista addressed at all? Or is there any plan or speak of reaching out to the Latino community there?
He did keep mentioning, you know, community outreach. One of the things from his background, he was involved in a drug task force. He did some undercover narcotics work for the DEA. So he has, you know, he spoke about that he has a lot of experience working with federal agencies. That's something that he's already done in his career and, you know, wants to work on here in Mesa. He's really been everything in 30 years of law enforcement. He was an officer, a detective. He's done training at AZ Post. So has a broad background of experience. And, you know, he was talking about how that does include working with other agencies.
All right. Live from the Mesa Police Department, KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening this morning. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway and Lauren Gilger.
The cliffhanger we have been watching in Britain may be more of a close call for British Prime Minister Theresa May. May's decision to hold elections 3 years ahead of schedule to gain a bigger parliamentary majority and stronger hand for the Conservative Party in the upcoming Brexit negotiations may actually make things more difficult for the Tories. But it's still been a tightening race with a strong showing for opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn.
Tim Bale is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, and he says May's gamble looks a little reckless as voters go to the polls.
She hasn't fought a particularly impressive campaign. She called this election in order to increase her majority, which was pretty slim in the House of Commons. If she doesn't improve it by 30, 40 seats, I think most Conservatives will wonder whether it was worth calling the election in the first place. And it might make it a little bit more difficult to get the legislation that she needs to get through for Brexit.
How much does she need more of a cushion in Parliament to have flexibility on Brexit?
It's difficult to calculate the numbers precisely, but there are about 30 Eurosceptic ultras, or headbangers, as they're sometimes called, who would really prefer us to completely crash out of the EU without any kind of deal. Most Conservatives, it has to be said, don't want that outcome. If her majority is still a slim one, then she is going to be dependent on those people, and that will make it a lot harder to actually compromise with the EU and get some kind of free trade deal with it. So she really is going to be looking, I think, still at a majority of about 50 or so to retain that kind of cushion that she was looking for.
Were you one of the folks who, when Corbyn was running last time against Cameron, who viewed Corbyn as someone with no new ideas, who was absolutely bereft of an ability to inspire the nation? And now, boom, we've seen something completely different.
Well, I was certainly a Corbyn skeptic, I will admit. But what he has been able to do is not necessarily inspire the nation, but inspire a particular part of the nation. He seems to have mobilised Labour's base, and Labour's base in particular among people who haven't voted before and among young people, much as, if you like, Bernie Sanders was able to do in the Democratic primaries in the United States. Whether that will actually do him much good in a general election, however, is another matter, because, of course, one thing we know about people who don't usually vote is they don't usually vote. And one thing we know about young people, particularly in this country, they don't vote that much either. So getting them to the polling stations and actually getting them to cast a ballot may be difficult. That's why, although the election looks as if Labour has been closing on the Conservatives, I'm not sure it'll be quite as close as everybody thinks.
And what's the chance of a huge surprise like Brexit? And what, if anything, is going to cause this tightening momentum to plateau?
Well, I mean, I think there's always a chance. I mean, you know, Brexit was a surprise to many people. The election of Donald Trump was a surprise to many of us, at least over here. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to write it off completely. In terms of what will actually block Labour's momentum, I think it will probably be when people go into the ballot box and close their eyes and think whether they can imagine Jeremy Corbyn as the Prime Minister of this country. And I think when it comes down to that decision, many people will flip over to Theresa May, even if they like some of the policies that the Labour leader has been talking about over the last two or three weeks.
It's curious, this result, that even though the terrorism incident seemed to accelerate the closing of the polls, when separate polling was done on who has confidence in whom regarding security, May clearly won that one.
She did clearly win that one, but she also has a record to defend. And in some ways, unfortunately for her, she was Home Secretary and therefore in charge of policing and in charge of security, and therefore is vulnerable to the accusation made by Labour that she underfunded those services for the last 5 or 6 years due to the Conservatives' austerity policies. So the Labour accusation that something more needed to be done and rather sooner, I think, does have some traction. On the other hand, of course, her criticisms of Mr. Corbyn as being soft on terrorism, he's voted against every single piece of anti-terror legislation in his career in Parliament, which is a long one, and he's on record as being opposed to Shoot to Kill, although he denies it now, probably does play against him.
Professor Bale, we are so used to, in the United States, focusing on the personalities of candidates, who you want to have a beer with, those kinds of things. But, you know, ultimately, it's get out the vote. And who's got the better machine here?
In that respect, I think we see two quite different parties. The Labour Party has put on a lot of members over the last 2 or 3 years. And it's the contention of those activists that that will make a big difference. In other words, they've got boots on the ground that the Conservative Party hasn't got. I think the Conservative Party is in trouble in terms of membership. Its members are slightly older and slightly less active than Labour members. But what the Conservative Party does have is an effective machine, quite a lot of money to spend, particularly on digital advertising. So we're seeing, in some senses, two different models of campaigning here. We're seeing membership versus money, if you like, and I think money in the end may well make the difference.
Tim Bale is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London. He spoke with us from London. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thanks a lot.
And that's John Hockenberry with our partner, The Takeaway.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.